When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to our academic podcast series on the New Books Network, a platform dedicated to bringing you the latest in scholarly publications across the vast array of disciplines. My name is Desi Vasileva, part of the team at Vernon Press, and today I have the distinct pleasure of hosting a special episode in honor of World Book Day on the 23rd of April and English Language Day. This date is traditionally observed as both the birthday and the date of death of William Shakespeare, the most famous playwright who wrote in English and whose work has had a profound impact on the modern English language. Before we delve into our discussion, and since this is our debut here on the wonderful platform of New Books Network, let's take a moment to introduce Vernon Press, an independent publisher of scholarly books in the social sciences and humanities. Our mission is to bridge academic research and a global readership, making scholarly ideas accessible to a broader audience. Vernon Press values originality, critical thinking, and intellectual rigor, principles that shine through in our diverse catalog. This interview is part of our exciting collaboration between Vernon Press and the New Books Network, aiming to highlight significant contributions to academic literature and foster engaging discussions on topics that matter. Today, we're here to discuss Christian Shakespeare, a fascinating collection that offers a deep dive into Shakespeare's work within his Christian context. It's a fitting contribution to today's collaborations, shedding light on the author's enduring influence. We're thrilled to have with us the editors of this collection, Michael Scott and Michael J. Collins, who will share their insights and explorations into Shakespeare's Christian context. Hi, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
Very nice, thank you. It's an honor to welcome you here, Mike and Michael, to the podcast. I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a bit about yourself.
Well, I'll begin. I'm Michael Scott. I'm talking from the UK. I'm actually a fellow and senior dean at Blackfriars Hall in Oxford, which is a private hall of the University of Oxford. So, and I've known Mike Collins since 1987, when he at Georgetown University asked me if I'd come over to Georgetown to do some teaching on Shakespeare. And in particular, what we were working on was text and performance in those days, the relationship between texts, the text of the Shakespearean plays, and the performance of the Shakespearean plays, and how meanings within the plays and the whole ambience of the plays, in fact, could change from one performance to another. We started that back in 1987, and since then we have been working together both in the US and in the UK. To this day, we became great friends, and we have lectured together, doing it as a double act, and we've written together and edited together. So that's me. What about you, Mike?
I'm Mike Collins. I am a professor of English emeritus and a dean emeritus at Georgetown University. As Michael Scott said, we first met when he came to Georgetown in 1987 to teach for the School of Summer and Continuing Education, of which I was the dean. We hit it off well, and not simply personally, but professionally. We have a lot in common, the way we look at Shakespeare, and particularly our shared interest in performance and the way performances shape understanding of the plays. And so the editing of this book was simply the fact we both did it together was simply an outgrowth of many years of friendship and professional collaboration.
Perfect. Thank you. Starting with the book, I would like to know, Christian Shakespeare, poses a provocative inquiry into Shakespeare's engagement with Christianity. Could you elaborate on what sparked your interest in exploring this intersection and the significance of framing this exploration as a question?
Yes, We have both been working on Shakespeare a great deal, and we keep up with the research that's going on in Shakespeare and the controversies about Shakespeare. One of the things that happened towards the end of the last century is that certain critics said that Shakespeare was ideologically Christian, and that the readers of Shakespeare and the criticism of Shakespeare was ideologically Christian, and therefore we were being given an ideological slant in education, and this worried people. This worried people about the nature of Shakespeare himself. So we asked the question: was Shakespeare Christian? And of course, Shakespeare was working within a Christian environment. And there's a difference between whether Shakespeare himself was a Christian and the environment he was working in. But that gets more complex, because Shakespeare had to be a Christian. You had to be a Christian within the context of the law. You had to go to church, and you had to be a certain kind of Christian. You had to be a Christian of the Church of England. But did that mean that you actually believed in Christianity? Does that mean that if you did believe in Christianity, that you actually believed in the Christianity that was laid down by government? So the whole thing became a question mark. And then it comes to us, the readers, and we have to say that we read from our present ideologies. So what is the relationship between the ideologies that we might have now in reading Shakespeare, who was reading within who was writing within a Christian environment, and Shakespeare at the time? What is that kind of relationship? Or for that matter, anywhere else in between? The interpretations change, because we change, because the audiences change. There is no such thing as an authentic Shakespeare performance, in the sense that an authentic Shakespeare performance took place over 400 years ago with a people who no longer exist. We're the ones who exist now. We're the ones who are the audience now. And so Shakespeare's work changes. And so there were question marks. How has it changed? How has the Christian element of it changed in terms even of its reception? So how has it changed? How was it different at the time? Because at the time, there was a lot of religious controversy. And did he believe in it, or didn't he believe in it? We will never know that. And how has it changed to now? I don't know if you want to add any more about that, Mike.
Yeah, I would. And just to bring up another dimension of that same question, whether was Shakespeare a Catholic or a Protestant? And of course, what does it mean if we say, yes, he was a Protestant? Was he a Church of England Protestant, or was he a Reformed Protestant? Or was he secretly a Catholic? And some of the controversy around that has become pronounced in recent years. People want to say, oh, he was a Catholic, and here's the evidence for it. Others say, no, he wasn't a Catholic. Here's the evidence for that. And that is another dimension of the question that's inherent in Christian Shakespeare. Was he a Catholic? Was he a Protestant? If he was a Protestant, then what kind of a Protestant was he?
In relation to that, I would like to know, and I'm sure our listeners would like to know too, throughout the process of compiling these essays, were there any findings or arguments presented by the contributors that particularly surprised or challenged your own perceptions of Shakespeare's work within its Christian milieu?
Yes, I think there were a number. I mean, we were dealing with some of the top Shakespeareans in the world who were sending in essays challenging the title of the play. For example, when we saw Paul Fides talk on Brownists. Paul demonstrated how the Brownists, a religious puritanical group founded by Robert Brown, was actually seen as a greater political threat than some of the other Protestant groups at the time of Shakespeare, that it was actually ranked with Catholicism in terms of being a danger to the state. This is very interesting, really, because now you've moved into the political framework of the time, and you were getting to see that religion can't be actually separated from politics. So the ideologies of religion might change and the ideologies of politics might change. So how does that interact? And that will take you on then further, of course, to say, was that any different between Elizabeth? Because Shakespeare was working in his early works through the reign of Elizabeth to the reign of James, who came down from Scotland. Robert Brown actually had to go up to Scotland at one time because he was so dangerous in England. He was so radical in England. But even the Kirk in Scotland didn't accept him, and he came back down. These are very interesting points that Paul Fides, for example, demonstrated and gave to us. I don't know if you've got any others, Mike.
Yeah, what surprised me in some of the essays was how explicitly Christian some readers found the place to be. For example, Professor Kilroy's contention that in the play Romeo and Juliet, Juliet is a figure in her way for Mary, the Virgin Mother, and that the play is about pilgrimage, about a very kind of Christian allegory is embedded into the particulars of the play. That surprised me. I had never really entertained such a possibility, it was argued out very, very strenuously, very carefully, and that was one of the surprises that came along, how differently people tend to read the plays and how they bringing particular perspectives to the plays come up with very different understandings of them in terms of that basic question, Christian Shakespeare.
That's very interesting indeed. One of the book sections deals directly with Shakespeare's spirituality, as you've already mentioned. In your view, how do Shakespeare's plays and sonnets reflect his spiritual outlook? How does this section of the book contribute to our understanding of Shakespeare as a spiritual or religious figure?
Well, I don't know whether we'd say Shakespeare as a religious or spiritual figure, because for the reasons that I've said already, we don't know what he actually believed. But within the context of the plays, you can find areas within the plays when a great sense of spirituality does come through. You think, for example, at the end of his writing in plays such as The Winter's Tale or such as The Tempest, you get this aspect of forgiveness. You get this aspect of the kind of love, and you've had all the love that you've had in the earlier earlier plays, whether it's be the tumultuous love of Antony and Cleopatra, or if you got the kind of very sexual aspects in terms of Troilus and Cressida, or if you go back to the young love of Romeo and Juliet and the forces of the materialism of their parents causing disruption and discord within the city. And but at the end, you do get this kind of aspect of, can we forgive? And is love about forgiveness? You know, so I think that comes through a variety of the essays. Paul Edmondson's takes a position from a position of being an Anglican priest, and as an Anglican priest, he does see Shakespeare very much in terms of the context of the Church of England, of the established church of the time, at the Via Media, which really Elizabeth had tried to bring in. I don't know if you want to say any more about that, Mike.
Yeah, I would. I was thinking too about Paul Edmondson. His way of saying it is that Shakespeare, not my words now, not his. You know, he's engaged by and has great sympathy for the particular, for the individual, specific things of the world. It may be so close to something that John Keats said so many years ago, the negative capability, the possibility or the ability of putting yourself in the place of another. And so from my point of view, I would say Shakespeare has endless sympathy for humankind, for the human condition, and a kind of, as Paul would say, although I don't think he ever used the words in the essay, a kind of sacramental vision of the world. The idea that what is in the world is in its way, without trying to put that in any confessional terms, but what is it, the world and the people in it are somehow holy. And that seems to be maybe a way into Shakespeare's spirituality.
Thank you. And talking about biblical influences, the book explores Shakespeare's engagement with the Bible across his comedies and tragedies. Could you discuss an example where Shakespeare's use of biblical themes or language significantly deepens the meaning or impact of a particular play?
I would answer that because I wrote the essay on Shakespeare and the parables. And from my point of view, it wasn't so much thematic or literal similarities, but it was kind of a similarity in structure between Shakespeare's comedies and the parables of the Christian Bible. And the way those comedies are put together, the way the parables are told by Jesus in the Bible, are very much alike. And they seem to come to the same kind of positive conclusion about that goodness somehow endures and prevails in the world, but not entirely. Shakespeare, as a critic named Nicholas Heitner, actually a director, says Shakespeare always pulls back from his comic endings. And in the Bible, as Jesus tells the story, he too pulls back from a fully comic ending. For example, one of the most famous parables of the prodigal son. When the prodigal son returns home, his father embraces him, folds him back into the family. But Jesus notes the other brother, other brother who has stayed and dutifully worked with his father, is not very happy, as human beings might be, that the other son, the prodigal son, is so easily forgiven and welcomed back. And he says something like, well, what about me, who stayed and worked with you and was faithful to you all the time? It's a parable about forgiveness. Well, at the same time, say at the end of, say, Twelfth Night, or maybe As You Like It, the character Jakes at the very end. He's invited to join the celebration as four couples are married. He's invited to join the celebration. He says, no, I'm not for dancing measures. And there's that reminder that even as we celebrate, other people are outside that comic celebration. So the way the parables are structured, the way the comedies are structured, there's a similarity there, I would say. And then what that leads us to possibly suggest, or to say it's possible that Shakespeare was aware of that similarity, and in some way his comedies are not just about the marriage of a man and a woman coming together, but they might also be about the possibility of that happiness in the world at large is possible. And there's a kind of providential force in the world that brings about that happiness. Now, is that true? Impossible to say. But that similarity of structure is opens a possibility, I think. Now, that's one. The other explicit essay in the collection is about Shakespeare's use of the Psalms. The interesting part about that is that the most literate of all of Shakespeare's characters is that abominable villain, Falstaff. He quotes scripture more frequently than anyone else, and so the one on the Psalms looks at the way Shakespeare uses the Psalms throughout the plays. Again, what does that tell us? That doesn't give us any answers, but it does suggest that Shakespeare worked in a Christian culture, and he was aware of one of the most important elements of that Christian culture, which is the Book of Psalms.
Your collection also examines Shakespeare's work through the lens of Christian allegory and theology. How do these perspectives illuminate new or overlooked aspects of his plays? What do you think?
Well, this is a very interesting kind of area because it has been held by some that Shakespeare isn't allegorical. In fact, when I was a student many years ago, we would have been told that Shakespeare doesn't write allegory, which is a little strange because so many of his contemporaries were writing allegory, that why wasn't he involved in allegory? And it may be that certain things that he was saying were uncomfortable or could be seen to be uncomfortable if you delved deeper into the play. So we have a situation where we've got a number of the chapters that actually start to look at the possibility that there is allegory here. So you get a chapter by Claire Asquith, for example, which makes it quite clear from her point of view, from that allegorical point of view, that there are embedded within the plays subtextual issues which are anti-establishment, which are working against the establishment, which in her case, the ones that she's talking about, relate to a recusant Catholicism that is there, a wish for the old faith to be there. So you've got that kind of level that's going on. Whereas within a chapter by John Dukakis, you have got a cultural materialist critic who is actually saying, and going back to Machiavelli, saying that Machiavelli talks about the fact that religion actually gives power to the rulers, and that there is within the Elizabethan and Jacobean age a problem about readings which demonstrate the nature of religion giving power. But Shakespeare does actually demonstrate that religion gives power. The whole notion of kingship is a religious concept, or has been made a religious concept by the advent of the of Henry VIII's Reformation. That Reformation moved the kings from being warrior kings who gained their authority through their might to, for the later Tudors, who of course, with one exception, were women. We're not proposing it within being warriors, but within the context of being divinely appointed, that Elizabeth was as the Virgin Mary, she was the Virgin Queen. And that power then that the king and then the queens had, and that's taken on again, of course, when the Stuarts come in with James. And it doesn't end until you go back to conflict, which will come with the civil war from 1642 onwards. So you get that kind of issue within allegory. What kind of allegory? Is it an allegory which is to do with actually, in some cases, to do with religious persuasion, i.e. Roman Catholicism, as opposed to forms to the dominant form of the English church, the state church? Or is it political allegory, which goes a little bit further than that? Well, it goes a lot further than that, really, which is saying, how does government work and how does it gain its power, gets its power by creating this concept of God and the idea of God? So here we have an example of what I was talking about right at the beginning, of seeing it. You see these plays and you see Shakespeare's question mark through a different lens, the lens of ideologies, different forms of ideology. I don't know if you want to comment any further on that, Mike.
No, I think that's done sufficiently. As I said at the beginning, I was surprised at the allegorical readings that arrived, because, like you, I was taught in school Shakespeare did not write allegories, and yet for some readers, looking at the play through that possibility, come up with very extensive explications of the plays in those terms.
Taking this to more contemporary context, Shakespeare's works have been interpreted through various lenses over the centuries. How do the essays in your book navigate the historical interpretations of his work in light of contemporary understandings of Christianity and literature?
Well, I thought I would call attention to the to one of the essays in the book by a woman named Elizabeth Schaeffer. What she talks about is the play Measure for Measure. Measure for Measure it turns on a very familiar folk tale or folk legend in which an evil ruler uses his authority in order to seduce or to try to seduce a young woman. In this case, the ruler of Vienna it promises a woman named Isabella that he will free her brother from condemnation to death if she sleeps with him. And Isabella responds to the ruler, a very famous and notorious line from the play: "More than our brother is our chastity." So our chastity is more important to us than is the life of our brother. And of course, to contemporary audiences, that seems somewhat excessive, to say the least. Now, you might ask yourself, well, what do I believe about the sexual relationships and morality of all of that? But certainly what Elizabeth Schaeffer suggests is that modern audiences do not take Isabella's commitment to celibacy. She's going to be a nun. She's in a convent as a novice. She's going to be a nun. But modern audiences don't take her commitment to celibacy with the same seriousness as an Elizabethan audience would, particularly from a woman who is going to be, who has entered the Franciscan convent. And so the question is, well, how do you negotiate that on the stage? How do you in some ways convince an audience to take Isabella seriously and not just dismiss her, as one critic, I thought rather mistakenly, did, as a hysterical virgin? And so she looked at a recent production of Measure for Measure with an actress named Lucy Phelps, who took that commitment to celibacy seriously and played it out seriously and successfully. But the problem is, it was trying to negotiate between a Renaissance, an Elizabethan, a Jacobean understanding of that issue and a contemporary response to it. And you get those kinds of questions and those kinds of issues constantly with Shakespeare. Now, we see it inevitably as 21st century people. Actors and directors see the plays as 21st century actors and directors. And all the attempts to try to suggest, well, we'll play it just the way Shakespeare did, is foolish, because you can't. And so that is an inevitable challenge, in Shakespeare studies. We can't go back. We can't figure out how an Elizabethan audience responded to Shylock. We can only play the plays the way we understand them as 21st century readers. And that is part of what, as Michael was suggesting at the beginning, that's part of what makes Shakespeare so popular, makes his plays endure, because they are capable of reinterpretation in the context of the culture that is reinterpreting them. There's no Hamlet, there's just Hamlets. Michael, maybe you want to add something to that?
No, I think that's a fair summary of where we're at. Let's leave it at that.
It is indeed a complex task to put ourselves in the character or the writer's perspective from different ages. But in the end, this is what literature is about as well. Now, having explored Shakespeare's work in his Christian context, what are some areas or questions related to this topic that remain unexplored or that you believe warrant further academic investigation?
Well, I think what Mike has just been talking about comes up in one of the essays in the book, which we haven't mentioned yet. And it's by Rowan Williams, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury, the leader of the Church of England. Of course, the head of the Church of England is the monarch, but he's the most prominent ecclesiastical person within England. And he took on the Merchant of Venice as being intrigued by bonds binding restraint and self-restraint. One way of reading the play, he says, is in terms of Shylock's attempt to break free of the role he is bound to in the play. It's a spectacle of a comic character trying to become a tragic hero. Now, that leads to, I think, what the book itself is asking in many ways. It's asking that question of Christian Shakespeare, and where do we take that Christian Shakespeare? Does that question mark takes us? And it takes us into a whole range of issues which are the modern contemporary issues about discrimination. The discrimination about gender and about race. And more than that, but the discrimination which then develops into war and what war is about. Of course, Falstaff, the man who uses the Psalms most of all in Shakespeare, Falstaff asks the question about war and honour. What will honour do within the context of war? But Shakespeare himself is constantly asking about war. And I think Shakespeare himself is constantly asking about discrimination. So how does the contemporary world look at Shakespeare? And the answer is, it looks at Shakespeare through what is happening now. What is occurring now? What's occurring in the Ukraine? What's occurring in Gaza? What is this waste of life that is happening, and for what reason? And are they there within that context? Is Shakespeare delving? How is he delving into it? And I think it's coming to the United States. There's a production with Ralph Fiennes in as Macbeth that's been in London, but it was done in an industrial building in Canary Wharf, and it's done in a war zone. You go into it and it's done in a war zone, and it's quite illuminating as a play. There's no need for the porter scene in this particular adaptation. There's no need for it. This is about war. This is what war is, and you feel the experience of war. And as Mike was talking about, the gender discrimination that is shown within plays like Measure for Measure, Taming of the Shrew, even Romeo and Juliet, this discrimination that is there. And, of course, Troilus and Cressida. So I think those are some of the areas that we want to take on further, but I think we'll come to our next book in a moment. I'll just hand back to Mike for that.
Yeah, well, I'm still thinking about interpretation, which is what you're talking about, and one of the I thought the most one of the most insightful comments about or descriptions of interpretation came from Justice William Brennan, who was on the Supreme Court some time ago. And he was talking about constitutional interpretation. And what he said is, we justices look to the founders to try to understand the words of the founders. And then we also try to consider, when we make a decision, the intervening history of interpretation. He said, but the most important thing, the final thing, is what do the words of this document mean to us as we read it in the 20th century, or in his case, or for us in the 21st century. Of course, he was his particular hermeneutic was that the Constitution is a living document, and the words must be understood and respond to the conditions of history, of the moment in which that Constitution is read. What do the words mean in the context of our own time? And that's, I often pointed that out to students. The same question is true for Shakespeare. What do those words mean? We'll never know what they meant with any kind of certainty, what they meant to an Elizabethan audience. That doesn't matter, really. What really matters is, what do those words mean to us as we encounter them in the 21st century, in the world in which we live today, as Michael said?
That is the question. As we wrap up today's special episode, I'm intrigued to hear about your next project with Vernon Press, titled The Christian Literary Imagination. This seems like a wonderful extension of our discussion, especially in light of our celebration of World Book Day and English Language Day. Could you give us a sneak peek into what this upcoming collection entails and how it relates to the themes we've explored today in Christian Shakespeare?
Well, Well, yes, we're really pleased and grateful to Vernon Press for publishing this this new book, which will be out quite soon, I think. What we're talking about with Christian Shakespeare question mark is Shakespeare's imagination and how that imagination is then put into theatre, how it's responded to, how it reacts with the audience in a historical sense or whatever. Can we take that a bit further? Can we ask about various books, different kinds of books that people might like and might see within that the use of a Christian imagination? So can we see it in a poem like Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright in the Forests of the Night? What immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? You know, what's Blake doing there? You know, what's going on within the context of that poem? What is he saying? How is he relating a spirituality there to the coming industrial revolutions that he's just seeing, that is being developed that the tiger is considering as a poem? Or what about later on with someone like Jerry Manny Hopkins, whom Michael considers very much within the book, and other people also comment on him? There are a number of Christian writers. Are they deliberately writing books which are Christian, so they are writing a Christian book? Or are they writing a book or a poem or whatever, which is interpreted as Christian because they are writing in a Christian environment? How is that happening throughout history? So we invited a number of people to choose a book and talk about the Christian imagination within the context of that book. And I think it's a fascinating anthology of ideas, of different points of view that comes through. I don't think it gives an answer to what the Christian imagination is, but it opens the question again, just as we open the question with Shakespeare. But Mike's my joint editor on that as well. And so what do you think, Mike?
What characterizes the book is the great variety of responses to that question. Tell us, choose a work of literature and that you believe reflects the work of the Christian imagination. And we had a great variety of responses and a great variety of understandings of what that means. I tried as best I could in an appendix to that book to define the Christian imagination. And what I came up with, and again, an imperfect attempt, I would say, but what I came up with is that what these writers share is the sense that somehow God is at work in the world, that the world is, for all its failures, all its disappointments, all its horrifying realities, God is at work in the world. And these, the people who write in that tradition, that may be the fundamental belief that joins them all together. We may not see God at work in the world. We may find it very hard to believe. But even in the darkest corners of the world, the Christian literary imagination believes that God is present. And that, I think, was kind of the idea, the insight, the faith, or the belief that draws and binds all of the writers who our authors talk about in that book.
Fascinating. I can't wait to get my hands on it.
Thank you.
Michael Scott and Michael J. Collins, thank you so much for this engaging and insightful conversation. It's been a pleasure discussing Christian Shakespeare with you both. And I'm sure our listeners are just as excited as I am about the Christian literary imagination. To everyone listening, we hope today's episode has enriched your appreciation for Shakespeare's impact on literature and the English language in celebration of World Book Day and English Language Day. Thank you for joining us, and keep an eye out for more inspiring discussions here on the New Books Network. Thank you so much. Bye.
Goodbye, and thank you.
Bye-bye, and happy Shakespeare's birthday. Bye-bye.
Thank you. You too.